A normal native helped break the color barrier in professional sports long before Jackie Robinson and others became famous for doing so. Duke Slater was born in the 19th century and played in the NFL long before there was such a thing as the Super Bowl. The NFL recently named Slater to this year's Hall of Fame class, marking its 100th season. Slater was the first black lineman to play in the NFL. He later became an attorney before becoming Cook County Superior Court's first black judge. Chicago-based author and sports historian Jack Silverstein took up Slater's cause to get him elected into the Hall decades after his legacy had been forgotten. Silverstein tells Eric Stock via Skype he started reading up on Slater last year ahead of the NFL's centennial season and dug into the league's ban against black players that came years after Slater retired.
He wasn't affected by the ban in terms of his playing career, but he was a good person to know because he was one of the dominant players in the league prior to the ban. He was certainly the dominant black player in the league. He then, during the ban in the mid to late 1930s, was coaching a number of semi-pro teams or all-star teams where the black players who should have been in the NFL ended up playing. So his story wove in a few different places, and that's when I learned about him.
So was it his success and his playing career that prompted the NFL to adopt this sort of unwritten policy of not allowing black players?
No, it was something that was already kind of on its way. It officially began in 1934, but it was moving that way starting in the mid-20s, late-20s, 1927. And Duke Slater was the one player who was the constant star. You saw a few black stars pop up here or there, Fritz Pollard being the first, Inky Williams, Paul Robeson. But Duke Slater was someone who had a complete NFL career from 1922 to 1931. What happened is that as stars left, as black players retired or they left the league, they weren't replaced. There was also a great contraction of teams, and a lot of the teams that were lost were smaller market teams, which had been the ones that that employed black players. And it was at that point where Duke Slater made his move from the Rock Island Independents to the Chicago Cardinals, now the Arizona Cardinals. His story is important to understand if you wanted to understand the ban. But of course, his story extends well, well beyond that. You know, All-America tackle at Iowa, an All-Pro player in the NFL, and someone who should have been in the Hall of Fame or could have been in the Hall of Fame with its inaugural class in 1963.
He came in as the first black lineman to play in the NFL, and blacks
That's right.
weren't generally given jobs as linemen because they thought it was too much of a thinking man's job.
That's right.
And that mindset remained a part of the football culture really for decades, did it not? And it seemed to extend to the quarterback position and, of course, to head coaches. And we're still, in a sense, kind of dealing with that, right?
I would argue that we absolutely are. I would argue that it absolutely remains a piece of NFL culture. If we saw what just happened with the most recent head coaching hiring cycle, I would say there's no way to say otherwise. The racism pervades to this day in the same ways that it did in the 20s.
So there are just two African-American head coaches in the NFL now after Ron Rivera got fired, and this despite a rule that requires teams to at least interview one minority candidate. Now, I'm not sure how outspoken Duke Slater was at the time, but what do you think Slater or his successors would say about that now?
I don't want to speculate as to what someone would say, particularly some 50 years after they passed away. As far as what Duke Slater said at the time, I didn't see much in the way of outspokenness on that topic. It certainly doesn't mean he didn't feel those things or think those things. I just haven't seen them recorded. Fritz Pollard definitely was someone who spoke out against those hiring practices, drafting practices, roster practices. But Duke Slater, from what I've been able to gather, that wasn't his way. I don't want to say that for sure, but that is my impression of him from what I've read. But nothing that I've seen has where he's put that on the record.
And it's understandable so little was known about him as we try to, you know, circle back decades later to tell his story. We're talking on Sound Ideas with Jack Silverstein, who is a Chicago sports historian who has followed Duke Slater's posthumous path to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, part of the centennial class recently announced. So let's go back to Duke's upbringing. He grew up in Normal, the son of a minister. Now, we don't know a lot about him, but I came across one story about him wanting to leave school. So his dad got him a job cutting ice in freezing cold along the Mississippi River, and that didn't last very long, so he went back to school.
Right.
How much do we know about his upbringing and how that turned him into the man that he became?
I think we know a good amount. I would recommend that readers take a look at the work of biographer Neil Rosendahl, whose book on Duke Slater is, if not the leading, certainly among the leading pieces on his life. But like you said, he was a son of a minister. I found a story that was in the Chicago Tribune by Phil Thompson, a wonderful anecdote that the high school he attended in Clinton could only afford to give football players shoes or a helmet.
In Clinton, Iowa. We should specify Clinton, Iowa.
Clinton, Iowa. Yes, excuse me. And his parents couldn't afford the other one, so he chose the shoes. And that was how he became a non-helmeted player, which is certainly a category of football player from the 20s and 30s. And so from what I've seen, he was an incredible athlete, but very thoughtful, very kind, soft-spoken, and someone who was able to sway opponents into appreciating him, well-liked everywhere he went. And I think it speaks very highly to what kind of person he was. I do think we have enough to go on, a really incredible life.
Slater was first a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame some 50 years ago after he had already passed away, but his legacy faded. And typically when that happens in Hall of Fame balloting, their name never comes back to the surface. So what revived the movement to get Slater into the Hall of Fame?
What recharged the conversation around his candidacy was that this 100-year celebration of the NFL, they expanded the senior class. Ordinarily, they only elect 1 to 2 senior nominees, and this year they set out to elect 10. And when they made that announcement, I think that re-energized a lot of people to advocate for the certain people who they cared about, Duke Slater being somebody who certainly has his supporters. Like I said, Duke Slater could have been in the Hall of Fame in 1963, the first year, or 64, 65. They started the senior committee in 1972. I saw articles talking about Duke Slater being someone who should be included there. He was a finalist 70, 71. They start the senior committee in 72. And like you said, interest around him just kind of fell off. You've got someone who is no longer alive to advocate for themselves. He played not just a long time ago, but crucially at a time when the game was very different. It makes it difficult for modern fans and modern writers to understand the value and to understand what this player would have looked like on the field.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas with Jack Silverstein, a Chicago sports historian, recounting the story of Duke Slater, a Normal, Illinois native who is now headed to the Pro Football Hall of Fame more than a half century after his death. Now, Jackie Robinson is known for breaking baseball's color barrier, and everyone knows who he is. His arrival to Major League Baseball came decades after Slater and others were already gone as they broke color barriers of their own. Do you feel it's sort of a shame that those like Duke Slater up until now and their sacrifices and the risks they took had largely been forgotten?
I think it's a shame that the racism of the day marginalized these players and maybe push them away, not just in ways that we think of in terms of, you know, the day-to-day indignities and cruelty that they had to face on the field, but restricting ownership opportunities. There's no reason that Fritz Pollard or Duke Slater could not have owned an early NFL team. And the NFL teams that were involved in the ban, four of them are still owned by the same families or co-owned by the same families. The Bears with the Hallis McCaskies, the Steelers with the Rooneys, the Giants with the Maras, and the Cardinals with the Bidwells. And you've got, you know, obviously the Packers are owned by the city, but Curly Lambeau is a piece of the iconography of the NFL and of sports. So I think that when you look at the opportunities that are available today and how are these decisions made for head coaches, for example, well, head coach is hired by the general manager, predominantly white, and the general manager is hired by the owners, 31 of whom of the 32 are white. And these things have been passed down through generations. So I think if you look at the total history of the NFL, and we've been encouraged to do that because of this centennial celebration, you see the ways in which the issues of the past really are still issues of the present.
That was sports historian Jack Silverstein with Eric Stock. The Hall of Fame will include Duke Slater in September. There are only two minority owners in the NFL. About 70% of the league's players are black.